Welcome to Going Mental. This is your host, Eileen Kelly. I'm interested in the things many of us face but don't always talk about. After spending 5 months at McLean Hospital working on my mental health, I'm back. A little more insightful and with plenty of stories to share. Expanding on my usual topics of sexuality and intimacy, this season takes into account everything I learned during my stay. I'll be bringing together a wide range of guests, some beloved, some contentious, to discuss work, love, and the bizarre phenomenon that is modern life. Join me as we try to make sense of it all. Today's episode is brought to you by BetterHelp. Have you been feeling depressed or anxious lately? I know for me now that it's the wintertime and it gets dark so early, it just takes a little more energy or a little more oomph to keep my moods up. And especially with this new COVID variant, I know I can get super anxious just thinking, like, are our lives ever going to go back to the way they were? I'm a huge advocate for therapy. I actually just got off the phone with my own therapist like an hour ago. But if you've never tried therapy and you've been thinking about it, I think this might be the perfect opportunity or a little push to get you to start. BetterHelp will assess your needs and match you with your very own licensed professional therapist. And you can do it from anywhere since it's online, and it's actually more affordable than traditional therapy, and there's financial aid available. So go to betterhelp.com/goingmental to schedule your first therapy appointment, and you can get 10% off your first month at betterhelp.com with the promo code goingmental. On today's episode, I'm joined by Esperanza. She is a transgender Latina feminist and self-described survivor of the sex trade. She is also the author of the blog Proletarian Feminist. Can you introduce yourself in your own words?
Absolutely. So my name is Esperanza Fonseca. I am 30 years old. I'm a transgender woman. I'm a survivor of the sex trade. And most importantly, I am a member and an organizer with the transnational anti-imperialist and feminist organization, AFFIRM.
I just want to say how I first kind of came across you and your work. I work with a good friend of mine, Ondine, who's like my creative director for the podcast, and she follows you on Twitter. And she brought to my attention your article, A Socialist Feminist and Transgender Analysis of Sex Work. So I think that's a good place to start. Can you explain to me how this article, Open Letter, came about?
Absolutely. So, you know, the first thing that I probably need to get into is how I actually entered the sex trade.
Yes.
Because in my opinion, that's really where my journey started, that ultimately culminated in this open letter, which reached a far wider audience than I could have ever anticipated. So I grew up in a mixed status immigrant family. I grew up working class, although we were somewhat stable financially, until my father was targeted by the state, specifically by immigration and the police. And that really disrupted my family's economic status, right? And it sort of plunged me and immediate family members into housing insecurity, among other things. And that housing insecurity followed me throughout my whole life up until even now. Before I went into the sex industry, I considered myself very progressive. I was in full support of full decriminalization. And I was very much sex work is work, period. Any criticism of the sex industry is not okay. It's ultimately stigmatizing women who survive in it. Well, fast forward a few years, I had made my medical transition. I was fired from my job. I was kicked out of my apartment, out of my apartment lease. My roommates forced me out, and I lost social support. That ended up pushing me into prostitution. What ended up happening to me, I won't recount. I recounted some of those stories in my open letter, but it was brutal, and it was a real eye-opening experience to the disconnect between the way that liberal media presents the sex trade in this empowering way, this image of this woman holding keys to her house that she bought from her OnlyFans, versus what I was experiencing and what women I knew were experiencing in the sex trade. I was able to get out of prostitution. It was a horrible exiting process. I was living on the streets, in a car, in a shelter, and it was a constant struggle to stay out of prostitution. I eventually made it out all the way, and I started to get involved in politics again, because who I've always been is that if I believe something, I'm going to fight to manifest it in the real world. And that's what I was doing. But I saw that all of these progressive, even so-called socialist groups like the DSA were supporting what I would call pimp lobby talking points and a pimp lobby agenda. And what I mean by that is if women like me who are exploited by sex buyers, pimps, and traffickers want to enhance our rights and our power, then it makes no sense to expand the legal rights of the very people that are exploiting us. Mm-hmm. In the same way, we don't want to expand the rights of the police over us. Why do we want to expand the rights of pimps, traffickers, and sex buyers over our bodies, our sexuality, and ultimately our consent? And that's when I decided an intervention into this conversation was necessary, not one that replicated old criticisms of the sex industry, which focused on the moral position of the woman, but a criticism of prostitution from the left, and specifically from a trans woman who considered herself a socialist and a feminist.
Wow, you just made there's so much I want to talk to you about and so many kind of points I already have in my head. How old were you when you first got involved with the sex trade? I guess that's a good place to start.
Yeah, so to be honest, my timeline is a little fuzzy because during that time I was so focused on surviving and mm-hmm. finding a place to stay room to room that I don't have a lot of exact dates, like maybe I would have on like a resume or something. But what I will say is that I was in the sex industry for around 4 years. And I believe I entered it at like 24 or 25.
In your analysis of sex work, you talk a little bit about your first experience with a John. And was it premeditated or was it kind of a chance encounter?
It was kind of a mix of both. So I was feeling this intense economic pressure mm-hmm. because I lost my job. I was looking for new jobs, but that could take months. Additionally, with it being the beginning of my transition, a lot of people don't want to hire a trans woman that doesn't look transitioned, if that makes sense. Like, it's okay if you're not fully passable, but what's not okay is if you look a way that makes people uncomfortable. And that's how I looked. And while there's nothing wrong with looking however you look, that had consequences for me in terms of who would hire me, right? A lot of my work was public facing. Do you want someone doing political work that looks this way? And I think a lot of people said no. So I felt this intense economic pressure. But then there was another pressure, and that was the pressure of being a trans woman who's trying to transition, you know? And we often face so much discrimination and hatred in society that the attention we get from male sex buyers makes us feel good about ourselves. Mm-hmm. And now, obviously, this doesn't apply to everyone, nothing really does. But I think a lot of trans women would understand what I'm saying in that because of the hatred we experience in society, the attention these sex buyers give us can kind of make us feel better. But it's similar to the way that any predator looks for a vulnerable person or a vulnerable group of people in order to make them feel special and make them think that what's happening to them is actually good or that this person cares about them when he's actually taking advantage of us. And so my friend, who was a sort of older trans woman, she sort of took me by the arm and took me out on the street. And then this man called over to me. And what I wasn't sure if it was a joke or serious at first became serious because I was like, I need this money and I'm going to do it. And it was a horrible experience. And I didn't feel good after, but I kept telling myself I didn't feel good because of the stigma against prostitution. But what I didn't feel good about is that this man was not only an older man, he was a man I had no attraction to. And I felt bad that I did that because I realized that I didn't really want to do that, but I had to. And I was like, is this my life now? You know?
Yeah. Can you explain the distinction between sex worker and prostitute and then why you tend to prefer one to the other?
Absolutely. So the term sex work was created in the 70s to represent any person who is in the sex industry. That could mean anything from cam girls to porn stars to strippers to private dancers to sugar babies to prostitutes. It really could refer to anything. And in today's world and today's language, often pimps are also referred to as sex workers. And you have pimps identifying themselves as sex workers. I prefer to use the term prostitute for a few reasons. One, because prostitution is what I was doing. Mm-hmm. Two, because changing the word doesn't change the system. And it also doesn't change the stigma. We think that we are destigmatizing women in prostitution by using the word sex work, but I don't think we realize that stigma doesn't change because you make something legal. There is a huge stigma against fast food workers. The way we think of McDonald's workers, Burger King workers, Taco Bell workers is a stigmatization of them. We look down on them. Right? But their work is legal and it's been legal forever. Right? At the same time, we know certain things that are illegal don't have a stigma. The most common form of theft in this country is wage theft. Employers who steal money from their workers. That is illegal. Yet there's no stigma against that. You don't see people stigmatizing these corporate bosses for stealing money from their workers. So we can't pretend like stigma falls so easily along this line of legal and illegal. It's far more complicated than that.
So you mentioned in the article that being a prostitute started out as empowering. How long did that feeling last before it kind of switched over?
Yeah, so I would say that feeling was very short-lived, but it was also a notion that I held onto in order to survive what I was going through.
Yeah.
So I look back, for example, and there were only two things that I ever wrote while in the sex trade. And for me, that's significant because I've always been a writer. Growing up, I had no friends in elementary school. I grew up in an abusive household, physically, emotionally, and sexually. And my outlet was reading, but also writing. And so writing has been something so important to me. In the sex industry, there were only two things I ever wrote. One was a letter to a former sex buyer who I developed feelings for. And I wrote to him about how suicidal I was because I wanted to exit the sex industry. I wanted to have a normal relationship, but I couldn't because I was stuck in it. And to me, that shows what was really happening to me. But then there was one other thing I wrote, and it was more along the lines of like, this is empowering. But when I look back on it, what I realized is that I was using that empowerment argument to make myself feel better about what I knew I had to do. Mm-hmm. Because thinking I was being assaulted or victimized in any way, if I thought like that, how was I going to get through what I needed to get through? Because when I post an ad every night, I need to shut off whatever is in my head and I need to become that girl in the ad, that girl in the pictures. And that means shutting off whatever feminist criticism I might have of the situation I'm in and pretending it's okay.
Was there a sense of dissociation going on to kind of get you through the work?
Absolutely. I mean, the things we have to go through. To give you an example, there was this one male sex buyer that I saw. He was this older man. He was a very avid sex buyer, one of the men who treats it very professionally. After he sees you, he will go on to the erotic review account and he will review you completely. Well, when he had orgasmed, he bled into his condom and he took it out of me and there's blood in it. And at that point, I was completely freaked out. I always had a fear of STDs, likely resulting from sexual abuse. We feel our bodies are dirty. We're always afraid, you know, sort of common. But now imagine this man you don't know, who's an older man, pulls out of you and blood on him. And you start to freak out. And then he threatens you with his ability to review you in either a good or bad way. So then what do? I have to be nice to him. I have to be accommodating. I have to pretend that I'm okay with what just happened and I'm not. And how do I be okay with it? I dissociate, right? Or disassociate. Dissociate. Sorry.
Dissociate. No.
Well, yeah. My second cup of coffee.
No, it's okay. I think it makes a lot of sense, like as humans and just like survival responses, like similar, you're even mentioning, and I'm so sorry that you went through sexual abuse or just abuse in general when you were younger. And like, that is a very common way that especially children deal with, you know, abuse or trauma is dissociating. So it's sad and painful to hear that you are doing something every day and putting yourself in a situation because you have to for survival, where you're kind of re-entering that space. What was your mental health like when you were active in the sex trade?
To be honest, it was horrible. I mean, you know, imagine being always on fight or flight. You're always in survival mode. And on top of that, you always have to be chasing money. That has to be your bottom line. Your income isn't guaranteed to you every 2 weeks, whether you do a good job or a bad job. And it's not even guaranteed to you if you do a good job, right? You have to go wherever the money is, and you have to do whatever you need to do to get that money. And on the way, you're going to be dealing with men who objectify you, dehumanize you, right? I talk about dehumanization because I think if someone is turned into a commodity, how can they be seen as a human, right? If all you see me for is what I do for you, which is to give you an orgasm, you don't see me as a real, full and complete human being. You see me as a means to an end, right? And that has a profound negative effect on someone's mental health, to be told that you are reduced to a commodity, to a fetish, that men can enjoy you in private, and that their money can coerce sex and silence from you. And then in public, you are hated because you're trans and you're a prostitute and all of this.
What do you think like some of the main differences between cis sex workers and trans sex workers are?
What I would have to say is that it really depends, right? I think that we have a lot of similar experiences. And a big part of my feminist project is to connect the interests of oppressed trans women with all oppressed women, because we do share something. We are all oppressed by the same system. So our oppression is going to look very similar. The way that a cisgender Black woman is fetishized in the sex industry is similar but different to the way that a transgender woman is fetishized in the sex industry. Different according to our different histories. Years of racism and white supremacy have shaped the way that Black women are fetishized in society, but also years of colonization and this European gender binary have shaped the way that trans women are fetishized in society. And so what we see is that among all of us, the similarities include coercion, violence, and exploitation. And then the differences are the particularities of how that manifests. So for me, it might be, a man who commits violence against me after he orgasmed because he feels like I tricked him. Many trans women are killed by sex buyers, often through strangulation, right? And for women, it might take a sort of different manifestation, which can be seen, for example, in the male sex buyer who killed, I believe, 8 women in Atlanta, Georgia.
So sad. Really, really sad. Like, really fucked up. Can you walk me through what the right to exit is and why it's so important?
Absolutely. So the first thing I want to say about the right to exit, and I learned this from our founder, who is a Filipina novelist and revolutionary. She says that the right to exit is the most denied right to women, right? Whether it is the right to exit a relationship in which women are experiencing violence and they are stuck in it due to patriarchal marriage laws or economic necessity, or whether it is the right to exit an abusive environment. Look at this rich celebrity Kesha, who couldn't even exit a contract with a man who sexually assaulted her. She was denied the right to exit. Now you see this happen to women even with money, right? Like her. Now imagine what happens to women with no money, no fame, and no power, who sit at the bottom of class society and who are forced into prostitution for survival. We are denied the right to exit it. So what I think we need to do in order to fix this is, one, decriminalize women in prostitution. Anyone who is trading sexual access to their body should not be criminalized, right? It is an archaic and obtuse law. We need to get rid of it. However, what we cannot do is expand the legal rights of pimps, brothel owners, and sex buyers. Because when we do that, the sex industry expands, and we have to provide specific exit services. Because in prostitution, unlike other jobs, what we are doing is trading access to our bodies in the most intimate ways, and that has deep effects. And so I think that the right to exit includes services that will guarantee housing, food, childcare, job training, money, all of these things, that drug treatment, therapy, all these things that allow women to exit the sex industry when they are ready to. And I think on that point, the sort of minimum program where we start is fighting for the equality model, because it includes these services. But I think that eventually what we need to be fighting for is a revolutionary transformation of society, a society and an economic system that doesn't put us in these situations in the first place. And that's my broader goal.
Yeah. How were you able to finally exit?
It was very rough for me. I had to pay my rent. My mom was very sick, and the doctors thought that she had cancer. I had to pay for my mom's lifts to go to the doctor's office, pay for her vitamins, pay for healthy food so that she could eat a nutritious meal and fight off whatever she had to. And it was traumatizing. I was brutally raped and my body shut off, and I couldn't work. I couldn't do it. When men would come and I would have to take off my clothes, there was something inside of me that stopped me from doing it. And I just couldn't do it. And they would get aggressive with me. They would try to negotiate with me what they could do to still come. And it was horrible. And eventually it got to the point where I ended up having to leave my apartment and go homeless. And it was a struggle. Really, exiting took me a year or more, where I finally got into stable housing and got a sort of permanent job. Even though in California, we're an at-will state, so it's like, can you even say I have a permanent job when my employer can fire me at will with no reason? I'm not sure.
How were you able to get on your feet after becoming homeless?
It was really hard. When I left the sex industry, and I was dealing with homelessness, a part of me was just like, I am so tired of being resilient and strong. My whole life, I've always gone through horrible things and come out the other side excited about life. Like, no, I could do this. But when you're in your late 20s and you're about to be 30 and you've been fighting your whole life, it's like, can I really do this again? Mm-hmm. And a part of me thought, no. Additionally, I felt bad about myself. It didn't matter what degree I had, what jobs I held before. I didn't feel like I could do anything, right? And a lot of it was my partner. And I hesitate telling this story because I don't want anyone to think that a man is going to save us from the sex industry. That's a misogynistic trope. And our goal shouldn't be to make women from being economically dependent on a group of men to being economically dependent on one man.
One man, yeah.
That's not what we want to do. But my partner, what he did for me is he provided me with a reason to go through whatever I needed to go through in order to get out. And so because I wanted so badly to be with him and have a real relationship, I was willing to go through all the horrors of homelessness and everything else to do that, because I was like, no, like I'm in my late 20s. I've never been in a real relationship with a man like this. And I don't want to be, I don't want to be 30 and not have that. And so I like this man and I want to do whatever I can to have a real relationship. And that means me being with him only. And that sort of gave me the strength to push through everything, but it took a long time. And it took experiencing what it's like to be told there's no shelter within two or three counties. If you have children, the wait time is going to be 6 months to get in the shelter. If you don't, it's going to be up to 12 months. And that's the reality for women who are fleeing these situations. Like, it's extremely dire.
What kind of safety nets do you wish there were for women that are in the situation you used to be in?
The reality is there are no safety nets. And I don't want to say this to scare people or downplay the role of the very few social programs that we have. But I mean, if you take someone through a journey of trying to exit the sex industry while being homeless and you call the resources, these resources are little to none. And I think that's what makes this fight for the right to exit so important. Because what we need to realize is that right now in 2021, women are being, you know, forced to stay in prostitution because they have no ability to exit. And this discourse that is so afraid to be critical of the sex industry ignores this very important point.
How common did you find depression and or like addiction in the industry?
I mean, it is, I cannot think of a single woman that I have known in the sex industry that has not struggled with one or both of those issues. You know, to be very frank with you, it's almost like, how do you get through this life without drugs? You know, I mean, first of all, like I said, you have to become the girl in the ad. Right? You have to provide not just your body, but you have to mold yourself psychologically, emotionally, to be this sort of companion, right, to this man. And that means suppressing who you are, suppressing how you feel, suppressing how you feel about what you're going through. And that results in depression and often in the need to self-medicate to get through it. So I've had friends that have died in the sex industry from overdose. I have one friend, her and I supported each other. We were all up and down California in Sacramento, like room to room, you know, posting ads. And her meth addiction got really bad. She was struggling with what the life of being a transgender woman in prostitution. And it resulted in severe psychosis, as well as an inability for her to maintain any stability in her life. She became homeless. She lost contact with all of us. She thought that people were trying to come after her when we just wanted to make sure she was okay. And this is the reality of life in the sex industry. And I think that's what the media is not showing, right? Or sort of downplays as like, oh, these are just horror stories that people try to scare you with. But it's like, they're not horror stories. This is what really happens.
Yeah. Was that a big, I mean, I couldn't imagine that it's almost like a constant fear for your safety. How do you protect your safety? Do you have a sense of community with the people you're working with? Are there background checks on Johns? How do you protect yourself?
Yeah. So what I want to say to this is that while we have ways of trying to keep ourselves safe, you are never fully safe in the sex industry, right? So as an example, let's say I was going on an out call to someone's house. I would almost always text someone with the address and the name or photo of the person that I was seeing. And I said, I'm going to check in with you. He booked me for an hour. If something would have went wrong, at least someone knows where I am. But at the same time, those sort of safety procedures are not foolproof. And I've often ended up in bad situations despite doing them. So there was a client, right, that like I screened and sent his address, and it didn't matter because in the room with me, he did what he wanted. And when it's his word against mine, Are you going to believe the prostitute, transgender prostitute, who you could pass off as being on drugs and crazy? Are you going to believe this, like, very nice, established, like, white man who owns his own house, you know?
Who was, like, the average John? Was there an average John?
The majority of my sex buyers were married men, or they were in relationships with women. All of them were in relationships or marriages with cisgender women. Many of them, when they would do drugs, they would get really horny and kinky, and they would see being with a trans woman as this sort of kinky thing that they would do on the side. I remember one sex buyer. He was this very racist Russian man, and he booked me and this other woman. She's a Black trans woman. And he was just sitting us down, and he was telling us how much he hates Blacks and Mexicans. And then he would look at her body because she was thinner than me and say that she had the ideal body, and then ask me why I don't have the ideal body like her. And it's just like, and literally they would do this, and it's kind of, you know, he was married, but he could only sleep with us transgender women when he was on literal GHB. And so a lot of times, right, what you find is that these men see us as like this like secret fantasy that they can indulge in. It's almost like to have a shemale body is to be like this freak that people are both horrified of, but also like kind of intrigued with. And it also means that like they're willing to do things to us and treat us ways that they know they can't treat anyone else. And a lot of times they know that we have some sort of desperation to be treated as human, because so many times we're treated horribly in public, that if a man is in private with us and treats us nice, that we'll let him do more. And so they often use that to their benefit. And then, oh, one other thing is that the typical sex buyer really changes where you are. Okay. If I were to post an ad in San Jose, I would get pretty much almost all engineers and people that work in the tech industry. Whereas if you go down to LA, for example, you're going to get a lot of people in Hollywood.
That's fascinating, but also just so messed up. And I wonder what it says just about cis men in general and like the society that we live in.
Well, that's what I think is one of the deeper questions is, you know, do we want to live in a world where men see women as commodities and where they see no barrier to accessing whatever they want sexually as long as they have enough money to get it? I think that's wrong, right? Like, sex, I have no hangups about it. Like, you could have as much sex as you want, as wild as you want it. But where my problem is where we have a system, an economic system, which is highly exploitative, where we know people are desperate to make money. And then we have the system of prostitution, which allows men with money to get whatever they want from women who don't have money. And that is where I say this is a core institution of rape culture, and this is why we need to fight it.
And so what would your solution be?
Ultimately, the solution needs to be fighting for a society that is not based in capitalism, patriarchy, imperialism, right? Not based in seeing other people, whether it's women or people of color, as less than because of who we are, right? That like a human is not a commodity, because when you turn a human into a commodity, you strip them of their humanity. And that is something that we have no right to do. And I think we really need to educate our youth to stop embracing this neoliberal sort of idea that anything that makes money is good. And if it makes money and it gives a man an orgasm, then it is beyond criticism.
And it's amazing. Yeah. What are certain legislation that people are wanting to pass or have been passed that you find harmful?
What I find harmful is legislation that expands the legal rights of pimps, brothel owners, and sex buyers. So what is being hotly debated right now is whether we should only decriminalize people who are trading access to their bodies, or if we should also decriminalize pimps, brothel owners, and sex buyers. And I think we should only decriminalize people who trade access to their bodies. And the reason why is because, like any industry, it really boils down to two groups of people, the exploiters and the exploited. I've been a lifelong union organizer, labor activist. I will fight to expand the rights of the exploited, whether they are McDonald's workers or whether they are women who are in the sex industry. But the line I draw is that I will never fight to expand the rights of the boss, of the people doing the exploitation. And in this sense, that is the pimp, the brothel owner, and the sex buyer.
And do you feel like that would give the sex worker more safety, or like more of a sense of safety? Because if it was legalized from their stance, their point of view, and something, God forbid, happens, that then they can go to the police without fear of going to jail.
Well, I have to be honest with you. I don't think the sex industry can ever be made safe, right? And that's why I'm an abolitionist. Additionally, and this might sound radical, so if you want me to explain, let's talk, but okay. I have to be real with you. Yeah. I also don't think that the relationship between the police and the people can ever be made non-antagonistic. And what I mean by that is we could decriminalize everything, but the police in class society exist to repress the exploited class. The police surveil the poor and repress the poor, right? It's like that is the function of the police, of the military, since class society and the state were invented. And so by decriminalizing this, we're not going to make the police any nicer to poor women, any nicer to people that they're trying to surveil and criminalize, right? Ultimately, that would require a deeper conflict with the state itself. What I do think the equality model can provide, however, is one, the ability for women who are in prostitution to one, not be the target of police raids and police violence, although being in this world as a working class person, as a woman, as a person of color, you're always going to be the target of that violence. But decriminalizing women trading access to their bodies in prostitution is an important step to at least attempt to reduce it, right? The second thing is, of course, then it won't be on your record when you apply to jobs, right? This also stops women from exiting, because if you have a criminal record, then people aren't going to hire you, right? And that also ties into anti-Black racism and xenophobia and all of this too. What I think cannot happen again is expanding the rights of pimps, brothel owners, and sex buyers, because then you're just making sexual exploitation legal and you're saying, do what you're doing, but now let's just make it legal and let's get some tax money from it so that the state can become the pimp too.
What do you say to people who say that, like, oh, prostitution is like the oldest job ever, you know, it's been around for, like, you're never going to get rid of it. That's just not going to happen.
Prostitution is not the world's oldest profession. The first mention of prostitution is around 2400 BC in ancient Mesopotamia. And it was written into their legal codes, because most people don't know this, but women were the first form of private property. When slavery was introduced in ancient Mesopotamia, the first slaves were women, and it was those enslaved women who were prostituted. And before prostitution emerged, we saw many other things that we would call professions that were happening, right? Agriculture, collecting grains, right? Farm working is far older than prostitution. Tool making, right? Making tools. That's something we would consider a profession today, and that humans have been doing for millennia before prostitution. And then, of course, childbearing, right? All of these other things, child care, that we know are professions and that have been happening. These all existed before prostitution. But what you might find interesting is that prostitution became associated with the world's oldest profession in 1889, when Rudyard Kipling wrote a short story meant to justify the British control over India. As we know, that resulted in the deaths, preventable deaths, of 35 million to 1.8 billion Indians, depending on how you estimate that death count. But Rudyard Kipling was basically describing an Indian prostitute, saying that she belonged to the world's oldest profession, and arguing that because prostitution in India existed in sort of local and familial ties, that it was a reason for the West to control the East. So when people repeat that, they're not only repeating something that's historically inaccurate, but it's also a racist phrase. And I don't think most people know that.
Okay. I want to talk to you a little bit about like the cosmetic industry and like how it reduces women to kind of just body parts. And I think it would be interesting to hear about specifically, you know, as a transgender woman and getting surgery as part of your transition and layers. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think that the cosmetic industry and the cosmetic surgery industry is a predatory industry that relies on women, and that includes trans women, feeling insecure about ourselves and our bodies. You know, with trans women, for example, do I think that surgery should be accessible to everyone? I do. Do I think that the plastic surgery industry needs to be heavily regulated, that their advertising needs to be heavily restricted, and that plastic surgeons who kill women need to be held accountable to the fullest extent of the law? Absolutely.
And that like doesn't really happen, right? Like I always read these news articles where it's like, you know, someone's getting butt injections and they're getting injected with like liquid cement or something that's used for construction and they're dying and the doctor's not getting caught or going away to jail. And it's just like, it's so crazy to me.
It's horrible. And I have friends who have gotten these silicone injections and it's extremely dangerous. I mean, even a BBL for a very long time, some say this number is now in dispute, but it was the most deadly cosmetic procedure.
We've heard that too.
Yet, why is it, like, if you know that there's a 1 in 3,000 chance of death from a BBL, why have we not shut down this unnecessary cosmetic procedure until we found a way to make it safe, if at all? Like, and I think that just goes to show you the class that is in control of our society, who makes the laws. If it were the masses of women making laws in their interest, well, ultimately, our interest would be in staying alive and not being killed by these quack doctors. But because society is structured to protect the interests of the private capitalist in private practice who wants to make a bunch of money by doing, you know, 3 or 4 BBLs a day, then we're going to keep it legal and allow him to keep doing what he wants to do.
But do you really believe that if we were to make, like, let's say BBL illegal, that it would stop people from getting a BBL?
Well, so that's where I think that like it, the solution is not just we're going to make BBLs illegal. Although what I do think is that when you have a situation in Miami where so many women have died from this procedure, you do need to shut it down until you study it and make sure that it's safe. You know, because it's like if women are getting sucked into these clinics that are charging them $4,500 for a BBL, that right after they're done, they're going to throw them out and not even give them post-op care. Why should they be legally allowed to operate with a medical license in the United States?
Yeah. No, I totally agree and hear your point. But what would you say to someone who's like, well, no one's forcing them to get a BBL? Like they're going on their own accord. They're consenting to get the surgery.
Yeah, well, I think that's the problem about when we talk about choice and consent in a society that is patriarchal and capitalist, because, you know, we make our own choices, but we don't create the choices that we make, right? We make our choices out of the options that were given to us. And we need to fight for a society that doesn't give people a host of crappy options, right? Because how can you say it's a choice when they're giving us the things to choose between, right? It's like there's layers to it. But I want to be clear. I'm just talking. I don't think that we should be introducing legislation across the country to make BBLs illegal. But I do think the fact that so many women have died from BBLs and it has been allowed to keep happening shows who our legal system is made for. That's the point that I'm trying to say. But I do think that there should be legislation which heavily restricts their ability to advertise, and which holds them accountable when women die or are botched by them.
I'm just thinking that I think women a lot of the time are the ones who perpetuate this comparison or this dysmorphia or poor body image with like social media. And like, if you see everyone, you know, editing their photos or everyone getting surgery and looking amazing and snatched, then you want it. You know, it's not just some like big boogeyman sitting behind a desk.
Absolutely. You know, and I think women can perpetuate patriarchy, right? For example, let's step out of like a Western context. In like a semi-feudal country, you might see women enforcing patriarchal family standards on younger girls, right? And that sometimes even includes physical violence on young girls, perhaps who don't keep chastity or whatever. So we know that all over the world, including here in the US, women are often accomplices to patriarchal practices and reifying that culture. But do I think that it is strategic to target women for what they post on social media? No, because I think the deeper question is, why has a company like Instagram engineered its algorithm and its platform in such a way when they've known for many years that it's harmful to women and harmful to young girls in particular and to their mental health? And so I think responsibility should be placed on these companies, right, which are creating the platforms where women are posting photos of themselves. And, you know, and I think that's where our target should be. And then another thing, too, is like, you know, I don't want to downplay the impact that a cultural movement can have. For example, like I don't edit my photos. The most that I'll do is like, let's say I snap a photo, I'll like raise like the brightness. You know, or like add details to some things, but I don't edit how I look. And that's just important to me. And maybe if a lot of people refuse to edit their photos, something could change. But I think that the target really needs to be focused on the companies that engineer their websites in this way and the companies that benefit from our insecurities and patriarchal standards of beauty.
And just engineer these applications to be the most addictive possible. Like literally have, you know, scientists coming in to make it as, oh, how can we create the notification or the like button? So it literally is like we're having a dopamine response in our brain. It's so wild to me. Since leaving the sex industry, have you seen a therapist or how have you dealt with, you know, kind of moving on from that emotionally?
Yeah. So, well, before I answer that, if I could just say one more thing on the last question,
which is
that I think that's also why we need to target this culture of commodification, because when women are commodities, we're going to have to constantly improve and update ourselves in order to be a competitive and hot commodity for men that want to consume us. And that includes women in, but also outside of the sex industry. And so it's no surprise that we're getting these surgeries and these BBLs and everything, because we want to be a hot competitive commodity. And men now expect that because of porn, but also because of other forms of mass media. And that's why I think it's not just about, you know, laws regulating BBLs, but it's targeting this culture of commodification that is rooted in very real industries such as the sex industry. On to the next question, in terms of if I'm seeing a therapist, it's a lot of emotional trauma. And, you know, part of my work is talking with other survivors. I talk to survivors every day, and we're all processing our trauma. And sometimes it comes back, right? And it's difficult. And in a way, I don't know if I'll ever not live with the trauma that I incurred in the sex industry. But what I will say is that when I had exited, it was extremely hard for me in particular to trust men. I didn't want anything to do with men. I saw every interaction with them as transactional. And part of my healing process has also been developing healthy relationships with men that don't see all of them as, you know, sex buyers.
So what would you tell someone who's listening who has been a victim of assault or rape? Yeah. Any like words of wisdom or advice or anything that has helped you kind of heal?
Yeah. I mean, I guess the first thing is that we are always taught to gaslight ourselves, to blame ourselves, or to downplay what we went through. The world is going to gaslight us enough. We don't need to do that for ourselves, right? If you went through something like sexual violence or rape or assault or even sexual harassment, it is not your fault. The way that you feel is valid. It is not an over-exaggeration, and you have every right to feel the way you do, even if that feeling is no feeling and it's numbness. When you are ready, I would highly recommend getting support that you need, whether it's support from family, from friends, or from a therapist. But when you have that support and you are ready to not just process your own trauma, but to politicize it in order to prevent other young girls and women from experiencing what we did, then I think at that point you need to get organized and join organizations of women like my organization, Affirm, who are fighting to change our society and our culture so that no other young girl or woman is victimized in the way that we and our ancestors were.
If you could go back and not go through that experience of entering the sex trade, would you take it back?
100%. I was a different person before I entered the sex industry. After the sex industry, I almost feel jaded towards life, and it's something that I battle every day. But the sex industry took a lot from me, and I try to recover it. And a lot of it I have recovered through my writing, for example. The sex industry took that from me. I wasn't able to write. My head was cloudy because I was surviving mm-hmm. every day. And my writing has been a way of me reclaiming what was lost.
When we first started this interview off, you said something along the lines of, like, before I got involved in the sex trade, I was very pro sex work and I would have been offended if someone said otherwise. And so do you ever offend people with your views on prostitution, on the sex trade? And like, what do they say? Like, what do you come up against?
Yeah. So I am the target of a vicious hate campaign on social media.
Oh, great.
And it's led by a small group of people who attempt to spread misinformation about me and direct hate on me. But what I've realized is that in person and one-on-one, women in the sex industry are not offended by my argument. They get it, right? Like, my friends get it. They might not agree with everything I say, which is fine. We're separate people. That's okay. We're going to have disagreements. We're going to struggle through them and get through them. But they understand what I'm saying. And the reason why is because I'm not sitting here thinking that I'm better than anyone else. I've done the worst of the worst to get by. I've done what you've done, maybe even more, worse, whatever. So there's no shame in it, right? There's nothing wrong in what you're doing. But I want to have a real conversation about, is this a world that we want to preserve? And I don't think it is, right? I think the world needs a lot of changing. And I think that women in the sex industry understand that. And they see that my message is not against them. It's against the people exploiting them, the people that exploited me, and the people that, you know, are pretty much responsible for all the problems that we're dealing with in this world right now.
Do you think there are examples of prostitutes and people in the sex trade who do have good experiences and do feel empowered? Or you think if they were to really take a harder look, that it's a lot of these issues we're talking about in this interview?
I think that they, if they exist, they represent a vast minority. The reality is, when you look at the global sex industry, the vast majority of us are not in there by choice. We're in there because of coercion. And the vast majority of us experience incredible rates of violence, sexual, physical, and emotional, and even spiritual violence. In no other industry, whether we're talking about the fast food industry or Walmart — I used to organize fast food and Walmart workers, so that's why I reference them a lot — I would never sit and find the most comfortable worker and expect everyone else to accommodate to them, right? What I go in is I find who's the most exploited worker, because this is going to tell us what this industry is really about. And so part of the problem in US media is that the voices and the concerns of the majority of women who do not have a choice and who experience violence, we're told that these stories are anomalies. We're told that the image of this empowered, independent sex worker is actually the majority of women in the sex industry. And that's why I tell my story, not to put trauma onto people. I don't want to recount this. It's horrible. And I don't want to make trauma porn that people get off to. But you need to hear it, because this is the reality. This is what most mm-hmm. of us go through, right? And this is directly resisting the whitewashing and the sanitization of the sex industry by the mainstream media in the US, which is directly a result of the sex industry trying to expand.
Where can my listeners find you and find your writing and your work?
Yeah, so you could find me on Twitter at End Class Society. You could find my organization on Twitter at AF3IRM. And if you want to check out my writings, they're over on my blog at proletarianfeminist.medium.com. And that's linked in my Twitter. But also, if you just want to have a conversation about how to get involved with the feminist movement, right? Because it's like, a lot of times we don't realize there is a feminist movement, and we're boots on the ground in neighborhoods, in cities around this country organizing. And if you want to get involved with us, feel free to DM me and we could talk about it over phone, over Zoom. But my goal is ultimately to build a real movement against sexual exploitation, but also against the system that allows sexual exploitation to keep taking place.
Awesome. Thank you so much. Do you have any parting words or any like last point that you want to make?
Yeah. So first, I just want to say how much I appreciate you for bringing me on. And to the listeners who have gotten through to this point, thank you for hearing this discussion out. What I do want to say is that, you know, a lot of people don't realize how this discussion affects them. A lot of times we think if you're not in the sex industry doesn't affect you. But I think that what we've discussed throughout this whole conversation is that the existence of the sex industry has an effect on the rest of society. And that means that every girl and every woman has a right to talk about the sex industry, because the sex industry fundamentally shapes the way that men see women. Right? It's a part of socializing men and socializing them to see women as commodities or as, you know, sort of sexual objects at which men can do what they want with. And I think that this is an issue that every woman has a right to speak on, regardless of whether she's gone through what I have or not.
I think that's a really good point to end on, because you're right. It does, like the sex industry, I think a lot of people think of it as very removed from them. But in reality, it does trickle into everyday media. It trickles into porn, which then trickles into movies and billboards, and then what you're seeing on Instagram. And that's a great point.